The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.
The FT.
Hello and welcome to World Weekly. I'm Sean Donnan, the FT's world news editor, standing in for Gideon Rockman this week. Hardly a day goes by without more grim news from the worsening conflict in Syria. The latest estimates are that more than 80,000 people have died over the past 2 years. And there's also plenty of signs that the international community is struggling to generate a coherent response. This week, the European Union agreed to ease its arms embargo and to allow member countries to arm the rebels fighting to oust the Assad regime. But we've also had more evidence of divisions in the rebel ranks, that Russia isn't entirely happy with the way the West is playing things, and that Iran wants to play a growing role. Joining me to discuss the state of play and where we are likely to go from here are Rula Khalaf, the FT's Middle East editor, James Blitz, our diplomatic editor, and down the line from Beirut, Abigail Fielding-Smith, who has been tracking the conflict in Syria for us for the past 2 years. Rula, let's start with you.
This conflict, since it's become militarized and eventually more like a civil war, has been in a military stalemate now for quite a while. You know, the rebels making gains for a few weeks and then the pendulum swinging back later on, and also for several weeks. But I think that now we are in a period where the regime has been making gains, and they're now making a very strategic gain, which was not really the case before, and that is their attempt, and probably successful attempt, to take the town of Qusair, which is north of the Lebanese border, and which would then allow them to have to connect Damascus with the Alawite heartland.
This is on the coast.
Which is up on the Mediterranean coast. So that's quite a strategic gain. And they've been fighting very hard, but they've also had the support of possibly several thousand Hezbollah fighters. And I think also this is because Hezbollah realizes how strategic this city is.
As this fighting on the ground has proceeded over the past couple of years, I mean, one of the great themes has been the struggle for Western powers and for the international community overall to come up with some kind of coherent response to this. But we have been seeing the move to this Geneva conference, what you have called Geneva II, Rula, to take place at some point next month, grouping together all the sides in the hope of getting some kind of peaceful resolution out of that. Is that conference going to go ahead at this point, James?
I think it probably will go ahead, because I think it's in the interests of all the participants not to be seen to be the person that scuppered it and to show that they have some kind of equity in it. So I think the Assad regime will turn up. The opposition, which is clearly very divided at the moment, will also in some way turn up. And of course, there will be regional powers as well. Now, I think what Rula has said is that the overwhelming issue at the moment is that the Assad regime is in a much stronger position than it was in a few months ago. And so the idea that this is a conference that's going to see some kind of serious discussion about a future for Syria without the Assad regime is not going to happen. So given that, given the death toll that's been on the ground, it's extremely unlikely that this conference is going to go anywhere. I think there is a very, very low level of expectation. But I still think it behoves everybody to turn up, try and look like they're talking, and so on. But it'll be over, and then we'll move on to the next phase of the conflict.
And at the same time, in terms of Western response, the EU this week eased its arms embargo to allow the arming of the rebels by member states. So we're already seeing people planning for beyond the conference in some way. What is the UK has been pushing this in a big way. What is their plan in terms of arming the rebels? What are we going to see?
What I think we're going to see, and I think we'll see it fairly soon, I think in the next few weeks, is the UK and France looking to boost the position of the moderate rebels around the figure of General Selim Idris, giving him what's been described to me as high volume but low grade weaponry. And I think that is what the aim is going to be. It's not going to tip the balance, however, strategically away from Assad. I mean, Assad's position is too strong. What it will do is reconfigure the rebels so that there is a there is more coordination around the figure of Idris. That is the aim of the British. However, I have to say that it's going to be a highly controversial move. And within the UK, for instance, I think there is going to be a lot of political debate around this, which we haven't yet seen.
And that is a political debate that is largely the result of the shadow of Iraq, if you will.
The opposition Labour Party looks to me like it's going to flatly oppose it. And I think that's going to become quite an issue for Cameron and Hague. Okay. As they go towards that.
There's also opinion forming that this is simply too complicated, that, you know, it's not easy to see who's the good rebel from a bad rebel, and that without a very substantial intervention, the balance of power on the ground is not really likely to change that much. So I think there is that opinion that's forming and that builds the opposition to the UK. But the UK and the French seem quite determined to push ahead because they think that the alternative is essentially that you let Assad possibly win.
Now, Abby, you've been tracking this conflict for the last 2 years, since the very beginning. You've also been tracking the rebel movement and their organization over the last 2 years. I mean, what is the state of the opposition, if you will, both on the political side and on the military side?
Well, on the military side, there are several quite sort of powerful alliances or kind of fronts have formed. Apart from the Fatah brigades, they're all Islamist ones, and some of them are there's Jabhat Nusra, who are kind of very extreme, but then, you know, you've also got Salafist ones like Fal Sham. So these are kind of groups that aren't just in one place, but have fighters in different parts of the country, and to some extent they cooperate with each other. I would say those are the more kind of powerful forces on the ground. Then, you know, there's ones which nominally play lip service to General Idris, but the fact is, and as Idris himself admits, you know, they have no real influence over these people on the ground. No one really wants to say they're not with Idris, but in terms of, you know, doing what he says or taking orders from him, it just simply doesn't work like that. Plus, you know, outside of these fronts, there remains these kind of myriad fragmentations of smaller groups, and, you know, as we've written about, some of these smaller groups kind of veer from alliance to alliance, sort of depending on what seems like the best deal for them at any given point in time. So it's still, you know, although there's some signs of kind of coalescence in some areas, it's still a very kind of fluid and diffuse rebel movement, which is very difficult to imagine.
And on the political side?
Corralling. And on the political side, even worse, in terms of divisions and lack of unity. I mean, this past week, there's been talks with the political opposition in Istanbul where they were supposed to agree to broaden their base and to, you know, a position for the talks in Geneva that you were just mentioning, instead of which it's just descended into total chaos and acrimony. And even as we speak, they're trying to kind of last-minute deal to try and at least sort of have a coalition that can supposedly be said to kind of represent all Syrians, but I mean, it's not clear if that's going to happen, let alone a coherent policy on Geneva. And there's some suggestions that, you know, the coalition may just become like the Syrian National Council, which preceded it. These umbrella bodies, this latest attempt at an umbrella body may just become irrelevant, and international players might just start bypassing it.
Now, Rula, you've met General Idris, who we've talked about a couple of times here. What is he like? Does he really have what it takes to kind of bring these guys together? This is the interlocutor that the West is putting so much hope in?
I think that the view in the West is that he could be a far more powerful figure if he is given the support. Essentially, General Idris is trapped between different pressures. So I think he is acceptable to a lot of groups on the ground, and they, as Abby says, they pay lip service to his leadership. But he can only strengthen this position and only make himself more relevant and have people listen to him if he is providing them with weapons and financing. He's not a military commander. He doesn't pretend that he's involved in operations, but he can be a unifying figure for the military, for, let's say, you know, maybe 50% of the groups on the ground, if he can buy their loyalty, but he has to buy their loyalty. And to buy their loyalty, he needs the money and he needs the weapons. And so far, although the Qataris and the Saudis have been providing weapons, they have not been providing them through him, nor is what they provide enough and regular. So, I mean, the rebels might get a shipment 1 month and then have nothing for 2 months. And sometimes they run out of ammunition, for instance, in the midst of battle.
Let's talk about the other side. I mean, the other big theme this week has been the emergence of Iran, almost stepping into the public diplomatic game on Syria, hosting a conference in Tehran and saying they very clearly want to be involved in the Geneva talks as well. How is that going to change the dynamic?
Well, I mean, that is just complicating the situation even more. And it just underlines how much the regime has had very solid support, be it from, I mean, Bashar al-Assad has dedicated supporters, the Iranians, Hezbollah, and Russia. And on the other side, you know, the rebels have had a lot of rhetorical support, but not that much in terms of practical support that allows them to change the balance of power on the ground. Now that Hezbollah is actually fighting with Assad's forces, you know, Hezbollah's fighters are more motivated and they have a lot of experience. And so they are able to make a difference on the ground, even though they're actually also taking quite heavy casualties. So I think it just shows the two, you know, the level of support that the two different sides have. And it regionalizes the Syrian conflict a lot more because it puts Lebanon at much greater risk of a spillover, of a direct spillover now.
Abby, you're in Lebanon right now. How is the Hezbollah involvement going down there?
Lebanon is very polarized, supporters and opponents of the regime next door. So the people who you would expect, the people who are against Assad, have been, you know, denouncing it furiously and saying that, you know, they're leading Lebanon into the abyss. I mean, what I'm interested in is how it's playing out amongst the Shia, Hezbollah, the Shia group, and these are the ones that are being asked to make the sacrifices. So far, you know, the message that Hassan Nasrallah has been putting out, which is that, you know, they have to confront these radical Sunnis in Syria, otherwise they won't be safe in Lebanon, seems to be resonating with most of them. I mean, they're as asked for, I don't know. But just also to add to Rula's point, I mean, it does seem like Hezbollah really have made quite a difference. The last reports I've been seeing from Qusayr is that, you know, although it's maybe taken a bit longer than anticipated, Hezbollah really are helping the regime make progress there. And that now completely cuts off the rebels from their support lines to the Lebanese border. So you're getting a lot of sort of angry threats from the rebel side now, how they're going to kind of attack Hezbollah in Lebanon. But there have been some rockets falling in Herma, which is the kind of part of the Lebanese border that's near Syria. I'm not sure there's really going to be anything that they can do about it. Hezbollah are making a very powerful intervention, which people are very worried is going to destabilize Lebanon. But at the moment, there isn't any kind of obvious blowback.
Let's wrap up with a quick round around the table and some quick predictions as to what we're going to see over the coming months and through the end of the year. James, what are we going to be talking about with regards to Syria when we get to the end of the year? How are things going to develop over the next couple of months?
If I had to make a prediction, I think the Syrian civil war will be continuing at the end of this year. There will be no resolution at this peace conference. I think it will take place, but I cannot see that there will be a solution that bridges the two sides, the Assad regime and the opposition. After that, I think we will see an escalation on the military side. We will see Russia pouring more weapons and material into Syria. We will see Hezbollah and Iran remaining firm. We will see on the other side the UK, France, and we haven't mentioned, I think we will see the US coming in behind the British and the French with armed shipments. That is a prediction. The fundamental question at the end will be to what extent chemical and biological weapons fall into the hands of proxies to the Assad regime, be it Hezbollah or alternatively be it Jabhat al-Nusra and the fundamentalists fighting the regime. That, I think, is still the big turning point question we haven't discussed.
And presumably what role Israel plays, another big name we haven't mentioned so far. Rula?
I think, you know, similar predictions, although I wouldn't be as specific, because I think the Americans will take a very long time before they come in with any with any military backing. But I think there will be some kind of a political track, but a political track that's more of a process, and that, you know, the real dynamic will remain a military dynamic and a continuation of the war on the ground.
Abby?
One of the main trends I see on the ground at the moment is these sort of divisions between the rebels, which we talked about, actually sort of turning into open confrontation. We've had, you know, first hints of that in northern Syria, particularly in sort of resource-rich areas they've taken over, and the sort of clashes over resources there. I can see that, you know, happening more and more as this rebellion continues in the absence of any kind of coherent leadership.
That's three very grim predictions and a sure sign that we'll be back and talking about this again on World Weekly. That's it for this week. My thanks to Rula Khalaf, James Blitz, and down the line from Beirut, Abigail Fielding-Smith. I'm Sean Donnan. World Weekly is produced by Katie Carney. Till next week, goodbye.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.